Today's episode is sponsored by Tego. For most of us, indemnity insurance is one of our biggest costs of practice. But when was the last time you took a look at the coverage and compared your premium with others?
Many of us are still with the same insurer we joined in med school or intern year. Thousands of doctors have made the switch to Tego and benefited from their personalised approach to pricing. You will also get an extra 2 months free in your first year.
If you are new to private practice, you might even qualify for 4 years of discounted premiums.
Tego offers competitive premiums, quality cover, and 24/7 support backed by top medico-legal advisors.
Get a free quote and discover why thousands of doctors are insured by Tego by visiting tego.com.au.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to Deep Breaths, a podcast covering topics related to the Part 2 anaesthetic exam.
I'm Dr. Kate Steele.
And I'm Dr. Kate McCrossan.
And today's episode is Have Another Drink, Part 2, where we'll discuss perioperative hypotension and acute kidney injury. In this podcast, we represent our own views and not those of our employers or ANZCA.
We're about to launch into a discussion of the findings and recommendations from a BJA article titled Role of Perioperative Hypotension in Postoperative Acute Kidney Injury, a Narrative Review. In part one, we discuss the diagnostic criteria for AKI, the relationship between perioperative hypotension and AKI, and lastly, revised features of renal physiology and perioperative care that predispose patients to developing postoperative AKI. If you haven't had a chance to listen to part one, be sure to go back and check it out before progressing with this episode.
So we know that perioperative hypotension correlates with an increased risk in developing an acute kidney injury, and we know that in terms of both our anaesthetic and renal physiology, the kidney is highly susceptible to hypoxic injury. So where do we go from here?
Well, before discussing any recommendations on how to reduce the risk of postoperative AKI in terms of the way we manage perioperative hypotension, there are some acknowledgements that need to be made.
So again, we need to address the second elephant in the room. There is no standardized definition of hypotension. We mentioned that in our last episode. Different clinical trials have their own specific definitions for what constitutes hypotension. This makes it hard to advise exactly when treatment of hypotension should be instituted and makes quantifying risk challenging. As well as this, specific degrees of hypotension as well as its duration vary in significance with different patient populations and levels of pre-existing disease and comorbidity. Some clinicians have suggested defining hypotension in terms of the lower limit of organ autoregulation and proposed measuring this through near-infrared spectroscopy as a way of monitoring cerebral blood flow. But autoregulation varies between organs and individuals. Indeed, even in different regions within the kidney, we see different autoregulation, and with the wide range of physiological states within the perioperative period. So this approach has not been adopted.
So where do we go from here? Generally speaking, research shows that interventions aimed at supporting MAP appear to reduce the risk of postoperative complications, including AKI. But there's limited data that assists us in our choice of therapy to support MAP. The effects of such therapies on renal perfusion and oxygenation have been poorly studied. Our evidence is restricted to two different sources. Limited studies in patients in whom renal blood flow, renal oxygen delivery, and renal oxygen consumption have been measured via renal venous catheters. And animal studies measuring real-time intravenous perfusion and oxygenation.
So we'll start by discussing intravenous fluids. Now, both crystalloids and colloids are useful in the management of hypovolemia as they increase the extracellular volume and plasma volume and subsequently increase venous return and stroke volume. It has been found that fluid loading with either crystalloid or colloid prior to starting cardiopulmonary bypass results in an increase in MAP of 5 to 10 millimeters of mercury and an increase in renal blood flow, but without increasing renal oxygen delivery, presumed to be from the subsequent hemodilution. Interestingly, this finding was more marked with colloid than with crystalloid, and crystalloid had the added finding of increasing the glomerular filtration rate. In addition to this, the fractional renal oxygen extraction was found to increase, which indicates a relative deficit in renal oxygen delivery. Animal studies have found that fluid preloading increases medullary tissue PO2. So while we don't see an overall improvement in renal oxygen delivery, fluid preloading may benefit the medulla.
So on to inotropes and inodilators. We know that inotropes increase cardiac contractility by agonism at beta adrenoceptors, resulting in increases in contractility and heart rate. Some of these agents also increase lusitropy or ventricular relaxation. And some of these agents like dopamine and levosimendan also cause vasodilation. Now, when it comes to interventions with these medications in the setting of patients undergoing cardiopulmonary bypass, drug selection functions predominantly to best support the heart rather than to support the kidneys. And in a nutshell, there have been very few studies looking at drug choices and renal hemodynamics. Dopamine is known to have direct effects on renal blood flow, but its use has failed to show improvements in renal outcomes. Levosimendan has also shown to increase renal blood flow and GFR, but studies on the perfusion of different regions within the kidney have not resulted in a clear consensus regarding its effects. Both these drugs could potentially protect the kidneys from hypotension, but they have no clinical role in the prevention of perioperative hypotension. The CHEETAH trial, a multi-center randomized controlled trial, provided good evidence that levosimendan did not result in any benefit to patients having cardiopulmonary bypass, including no benefit on the incidence of post-bypass AKI.
Now, there's quite a lot to cover regarding vasopressors, so please bear with us. Now, starting with noradrenaline, as well as causing vasoconstriction, it also results in positive inotropic and chronotropic effects via its beta agonism. In post-cardiac surgical patients, noradrenaline infusion increasing the MAP from about 60 millimeters of mercury to about 75 millimeters of mercury was associated with increases in cardiac output and renal oxygen delivery. However, there was also no change to renal oxygen consumption despite an increase in glomerular filtration rate. Similar results have been found in patients post-liver transplant and in both healthy and septic sheep models. But in these studies, noradrenaline actually induced renal medullary ischemia and hypoxia. So despite the whole kidney effects of noradrenaline appearing to be favourable, its effects on regional kidney perfusion, oxygenation and acute kidney injury risk are less so, and the drug ultimately requires further study.
The next vasopressor addressed in the article is phenylephrine. Human observations have shown a tendency to reduce renal blood flow, but with a well-maintained GFR and thus an increased filtration fraction. In healthy and septic sheep models, it was found to have little effect on renal blood flow and to have a similar profile in renal effects as that of noradrenaline. The authors are not aware of any studies examining the effects of phenylephrine on regional kidney perfusion and oxygenation.
Next is metaraminol, a direct and indirect acting sympathomimetic. In a sheep model of cardiopulmonary bypass, metaraminol was found to dose-dependently increase systemic vascular resistance, but without increasing renal vascular resistance. This resulted in increased renal blood flow, renal oxygen delivery, as well as increased medullary and cortical PO2. The authors posit that metaraminol may in fact protect the kidney from ischemia and hypoxia during cardiopulmonary bypass, but there don't appear to be any clinical trials in humans attempting to corroborate these findings.
Vasopressin has until recently been used as a second-line vasopressor. Recently, however, two different trials have shown improved outcomes with vasopressin when compared to noradrenaline in two specific clinical circumstances. The first trial, the VANCS trial, compared vasopressin to noradrenaline in the management of shock after cardiac surgery and found that in patients with vasoplegic syndrome, vasopressin rather than noradrenaline reduced the incidence of mortality or severe postoperative complications, including AKI. The second trial, the VAST trial, found that vasopressin was superior to noradrenaline with regard to the incidence of AKI in patients treated for septic shock, but no overall benefit in terms of overall mortality was found. However, in another clinical trial, the VANCS 2 trial, in which cancer patients who developed septic shock were treated with either vasopressin or noradrenaline, vasopressin was not superior to noradrenaline in terms of 28-day mortality or other outcomes, including AKI. In both human patients after cardiopulmonary bypass and in healthy and septic sheep models, vasopressin has been found to decrease renal blood flow and increase the renal fraction of oxygen extraction. In sheep models, however, medullary tissue decreases in PO2 were not as marked as those seen with noradrenaline. In a nutshell, though vasopressin appears to decrease renal oxygenation, renal medullary oxygenation appears well preserved.
The last vasopressor discussed in this article is actually not available in either Australia or New Zealand at this time, to my knowledge. This medication is angiotensin II, and the brand name is Giapreza. This medication has been shown as an effective vasopressor in the management of distributive or vasodilatory shock and appears to improve renal function in experimental sepsis without exacerbating renal medullary hypoxia.
This article has a fantastic table in which all of the inotropes and vasopressors are summarised in terms of their pharmacology, advantages, disadvantages and contraindications. It's a brilliant and easy read, and we'd strongly encourage everyone to take a look. It's a much more complete summary than we can offer in our episode, so be sure to check it out.
So where do we go from here? So we know that there is a relationship between perioperative hypotension and acute kidney injury. We know that there are many reasons and mechanisms contributing to the increased risk of acute kidney injury, particularly in the context of having anaesthesia and surgery.
There are a couple of major barriers when it comes to progress in research investigating methods for reducing the risk of postoperative AKI. And one of the main barriers is that there is no validated methods to monitor regional kidney perfusion and oxygenation in the perioperative period. Another significant issue is the lack of a reliable and universally agreed upon definition of what constitutes hypotension. And there is much uncertainty within the community as to whether interventions that increase MAP are actually beneficial and what the optimal target MAP actually is. We also have no idea as to what comprises the best therapeutic approach to this problem.
So ultimately, and I'm sure it comes as no surprise to anyone listening, but what the authors have advised is that more research is needed, and innovation in how to better measure reliably and consistently parameters like renal blood flow, renal oxygen delivery and consumption, and renal tissue PO2 have never been more important.
So I know this article isn't able to really provide evidence as to interventions we can employ to try and reduce the risk of AKI in our patients, but is there anything that in particular that you're taking away from this discussion?
Oh, look, that's a tough one to answer beyond that I'm much more aware of the perioperative issues contributing to postoperative acute kidney injury and unable to decisively know how to reduce my patient's risk, which is frustrating. So I think the outcomes of the animal trials with metaraminol are promising, but I have no idea how that will relate to my patients, being that there are no human trials specifically looking at metaraminol with its effects on, you know, renal parameters. And I suppose I ultimately feel uncertain as to what I can do to really reduce my patient's risk, and that's a little difficult to swallow, really, particularly in the age where there's so much research and innovation in many other facets of our practice.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, you know, maybe it's the whole anaesthesia thing of just keep everything as normal as possible. But yeah, it's a very specific topic for investigation and there's many uncertainties and variables. So until there's a consensus on things like the definition of hypotension, research is going to be difficult in this area.
Yeah, I completely agree. Well, that brings us to the end of another episode. But before we say farewell, Kate, what have you learned this week in anaesthesia?
Well, look, I think, you know, I work at a fairly large hospital with a very varied case mix and every now and again you get presented with something you haven't done for a while. And in my case it was laser surgery on the airway. Yeah, so you kind of know the principles and, I mean, I'm trying to think when the last time I'd done ENT, but it had been a while since I'd done a laser case. But, you know, you just go back to your training and your first principles and you ask, you know, I asked a colleague of mine who does it much more regularly than me and, yeah, you make it work and make some sensible decisions.
Yeah.
And so that's it really. It's just about if you do encounter something that you haven't done for a while, classics are things like DLTs.
Yeah.
Yeah, sort of unusual things, slightly more unusual things that you just don't see frequently. Just go back to your training, I guess, and it's in back in the memory somewhere.
Yeah, and notes. I find myself referring to my part two notes
a lot.
So, you know, for those out there who are studying for the part two, actually make sure that you make good notes and that they're legible and interpretable because it's amazing how much you go back to just revise when you haven't done a particular type of anaesthesia or for a particular case. It's actually really useful. So make sure you do make some good notes. It's a marathon, not a sprint. So.
Yes, and, you know, it's funny how little goes out. Things do change, but also a lot stays the same.
A lot stays the same. It's amazing, isn't
it? So what about you? What have you learnt this week in anaesthesia?
Well, I've been playing around with dexmedetomidine, so I find I'm increasingly intrigued.
Putting it in my blocks.
I find I'm increasingly intrigued with opioid-free anaesthesia. Oh. And it's something I haven't really been exposed to that much. And I've been, for longer cases where I think pain is going to be an issue, and particularly in individuals where I think they can handle it, I've been starting to use like multiple infusions, and one of them is dexmedetomidine, which thus far in training, we were never really allowed to use it because when we were going through training, it was really expensive. So I only ever saw it, I can count on one hand the number of times I saw it used clinically, but I'm starting to, now that it's a bit easier to get access to, and there's more and more evidence coming out that it's really good for pain relief, I'm starting to play around to see if I can opioid spare as much as possible in certain patients. And it's actually amazing how much you can opioid spare when you've got So a clinical example I had was I had a patient that I really didn't want to suffer from the effects of opioid narcosis. Mm. And so I adopted an opioid-free approach to this patient's surgery. This patient was having a laparotomy for bowel-related pathology. And I had a lignocaine infusion, a dexmedetomidine infusion, magnesium, ketamine.
Yeah.
And I managed to get – and a young patient, so a 40-something-year-old opioid-naive patient, and I managed to get this patient through the surgery with nothing but 200 of fentanyl that I gave on induction. And it was amazing. It's actually – it goes to show – yes. Well, I for other reasons that we will not go into, they ended up going intubated to intensive care because oxygenation had been a problem during the case. But in every other facet, hemodynamically very robust – I tried my very best to extubate them at the end of the case, but their oxygenation was just not good enough. Their gas exchange was quite poor. But this patient with no opioids on board and a big laparotomy had a resp rate of like 8, good tidal volumes, looked very, very comfortable, not hypertensive, not hypotensive either, not tachycardic. It just looked beautiful, but for the fact that their gas exchange was not ideal. So
what are you giving, like 1 mic per kilo over 10 minutes and then –
No, so I actually – I won't dob anyone in, but there is a particular anaesthetist that works at your hospital, Kate, that actually has a list of things that they do for opioid-free anaesthesia, and I got hold of that list. And at induction, I just give a 10-mic bolus, and then I do no more than 1 mic per kilogram per hour as an infusion rate.
Yep.
And then depending on hemodynamics, if they're not tolerating that, I'll drop it down. So I have done 1 mic per kilo for young people. For older individuals, I would probably drop it down to 0.5. And then the only other thing I try very hard to do is stop it almost an hour before the expected end of surgery, because I obviously want them to wake up. And that goes – that's
like
true
me and
for
lignocaine.
Yeah, and that's true for lignocaine as well. If you don't stop it early enough, you need to stop it a good 30, 40 minutes beforehand. Otherwise, they just don't wake up. So, but it's been going well. So it's very early days, but watch this space. Yeah, I'm sure I'll talk more about it in the future.
Try something different.
Yeah, exactly. Live a little dangerously, or about as dangerously as risk-averse anaesthetists can.
Well, that's all we have time for on today's episode of Deep Breaths. Don't forget to claim CPD if you're a provisional fellow or consultant. If you like what you hear, please rate us on your favourite podcast platform.
And you can always get in touch with us at deepbreathspod@gmail.com with suggestions, questions, or just to say hi. Thanks for listening, and we hope you can join us next time on Deep Breaths.